All right. Good morning. Welcome to Wednesday of week two. A couple of announcements. So one, today's HCS seminars are at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. These are optional. These are for you to get a little more comfortable and also a little more savvy with Linux and the like, being offered again by Harvard's Computer Society. So 1 p.m., 7 p.m., Science Center 229, just so that those guys know who to expect. Just email, as we said on Monday, CS50 plus RSVP at FAS, just so that they have a sense of who to expect. Sections. We're in the process of just finalizing section details. If you still have questions, concerns, if you need to be moved, just contact CS50 plus heads at FAS. Thomas and Katie will take care of that. And then finally, especially as problem sets 1's due date is coming up, know how many hours exist in the way of help with office hours, virtual office hours, and also today's super section. This super section is at 3 p.m. in Science Center B. And again, especially if you felt a little overwhelmed in sections this week or missed section this week, know that this is an opportunity to recover some of that same material, but presumably with a different person leading the section and also with different examples. So an example to perhaps motivate some of what we're doing today, along the lines of some of the cool things you can do when you know how to program. So you know that CS50 has this website, and there's information that's hopefully useful on it. And when you have 20 plus people holding office hours at different times of the week, it's a pain, if nothing else, to have to go into a website, open up a text editor, and edit, say, HTML, which, for those familiar, is the language in which web pages are written. Much better, especially since these pieces of data are recurring, if we can automate as many of these processes as possible. And in fact, much of what the TFs and I have been doing over the past couple of weeks is writing tools in various languages, C, Perl, PHP, and the like, to make our lives easier and ultimately provide you guys with more information. So for instance, you see now that we have this list of office hours and virtual office hours, and just by clicking the appropriate link, you can, for instance, filter by physical office hours, where we're actually there in person, or you can click on just virtual. Now, one of the cool, dare I say, sexy features of this thing now is that it automatically updates itself such that on the right-hand side, it's always going to tell you when the next set of office hours or virtual office hours are. And just to give you a sense of how we do this, well, what we did was sort of arbitrarily create this configuration file. We call it officehours.csv, comma separated variables. It's essentially an Excel file that we can manually edit. And you see here the way in which we're representing on the server all of these office hours. And suppose, just for fun, I wanted to go ahead and say, all right, so the next office hours aren't until 1 p.m. today. Let's see if we can't put someone there sooner. So I'm going to say on Wednesday, let's say 10 a.m. to 11 a.m., we're going to put, say, Andrew there, put him in the Science Center. I'm going to save this file. And now if I waited 60 seconds, the website would automatically update itself. But I'll hit refresh. And now it appears that, it appears that on the right-hand side, we do see the blinking, and we have this sexy in-progress indicator on the course's website. So if I'm among the few who get a kick out of this, I guess it makes sense that I'm teaching up here. But this is, again, just testament to the kinds of things that you can do. And it's, yeah, this is kind of cute and fun. But the point for us is to save time and make it easier for us to maintain this kind of data. And presumably, you guys in courses outside of 50 and student groups outside of 50 presumably might find exactly these kinds of problems where you can save yourself and, dare say, others time. Question? The website is written mostly in PHP with a bit of Perl code, and what you're seeing now is an instance of a technology, so to speak, called Ajax, which allows the website to automatically update itself internal to the page without actually reloading the whole page. So every minute, the website updates itself without you seeing one mass reload of the page. So for those of you interested in doing more among the more sophisticated web-based projects at the end of the term, know that Ajax might be something you want to check out, or perhaps we'll offer some kind of super section on it. There we go. Andrew is no longer in the Science Center. So any questions before we forge ahead today? All right, so last time was a bit syntax heavy. You could sort of hear the in the back of the room on Monday. So today we're going to try to focus a bit more on thinking and on answering a couple of questions conceptually and problems, albeit by way of several additional examples. So a quick look back, though, at Monday. We looked at these various beer 1, beer 2, beer 3, and beer 4 examples to just look at loops again. But we also introduced this idea, this scary word of hierarchical decomposition, which was just this big way of saying that if you've got some problem, say in beer 3, I think it was. Yep. If you've got some problem like beer3.c, which granted is not a large program, but conceptually there's sort of a chunk of code there that would sort of make sense to rip out and make it its own sort of routine, well, we introduced the idea of functions. So in layman's terms, what's a function when it comes to programming? What's a function? Surely one of you must know. Yeah. Okay, so lots of somethings in that sentence, but that's right. So let me rephrase this. It's sort of like a miniature program, is how we define it, that does something, that does some predetermined task that either you or someone else implements that you can summon, that you can call upon to actually do some task. What's an example of a function that you did not write but that you've been using for many days now? All right, so printf, and also if you've used getString or getint, those are functions that we, the staff, wrote. And incidentally, we did, for those curious, publish to the course's website as of a few minutes ago, CS50's library. The source code is now available for those of you who want to take a look. We'll eventually look at it in class, but for those of you who are compiling software on your own computers, know that you can download that code and set it up on your own machines. And look to the bulletin board if you want some assistance with doing that with GCC, with LCC, Visual Studio, on your own computers. But for now, CS50's library is a perfect example of something with a whole bunch of functions in it. If we look then at beer 4, which was the last of those examples, what we did here was what? Well, we kept swapping in and out for loops and while loops just to emphasize the point that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Whatever is conceptually most clear to you, you can use. But we kept calling upon chorus, and chorus was a function. And functions, as you perhaps remember, can take inputs optionally, and they can produce outputs. So that's quite obvious with printf, because the inputs you're providing it are typically what? So there's some whispers. What's the first thing you pass to printf? Yeah, so it's string. It's formatting string, so to speak, and then optionally zero or more additional arguments, like the numbers to print or the actual strings to print. So we saw in beer 4 just that I chose to factor out, so to speak, some of that code that conceptually made sense to rip out of main and put it in its own routine here. This will become more compelling the more complicated your programs get. Very soon will you not want to write your entire programs in main because they quickly become unwieldy, and also you'll find that it's quite useful sometimes to call the same function multiple times. Consider printf. Well, eventually you'll be writing your own functions that just make good sense to call yourself, to invoke yourself, so that you're not copying and pasting the same kind of code. And in fact, that's an excellent rule of thumb. If you ever find yourself, be it for problem set 1 or particularly problem set 2 and beyond, copying your own code and pasting it and maybe tweaking a couple of characters or numbers, it's a perfect candidate for factoring that code out, making it a function that presumably takes some inputs and maybe produces some outputs to actually control its behavior. So with that look back, let's take a look ahead at what might be puzzling at first. So suppose that in the spirit of writing reusable code, like printf, I want to write a function whose purpose in life is to swap two values. So two values will be ints in this case, and the sole purpose of this method, of this function, is to take in an int a and an int b, to put one value here, the other value in here, and then hopefully the user will be satisfied that the two variables that he passes to this function will have been swapped. Well, let's take a look at buggy3.c. And clearly this is a leading question, else it wouldn't be called this. So here's a main routine. Consider this a little test program. In layman's terms, looking at main, what's this program designed to do, irrespective of whether or not it does that? Yeah. Perfect. So switch the values of x and y, which initially appear to be 1 and 2. Then in the middle there, where you see this call, so to speak, to swap, passing in x and y as the so-called arguments, presumably that's where the magic happens. Then after swap returns, so to speak, finishes executing, we're going to print swapped, and then we're going to reprint out the values x and y. So ideally, we're going to see 1 and then 2, and then hopefully 2 and then 1. But again, we promised a leading question here. If we go ahead and compile buggy3.c and then go ahead and run a.out, unfortunately, the program's lying. It's not working. So why is this the case? Well, let's take a look at the source. Main was not terribly enlightening, but here's swap. copied from that PowerPoint slide. Why does this not work? Okay, so right answer. It's passed by value. It's not passed by reference or pointer. Let me re-present the question, though. Those of you who say don't even know that jargon, conceptually, why might this not be working, even though it looks like this function takes two ints, and if my intuition is correct, I'm creating a temporary variable, and I'm moving one value into it, I'm moving the other variable back into that place, and then finally I'm moving this guy here. So conceptually, it is like I'm swapping two values. Something's wrong. Yeah, so these variables are now sort of quote-unquote out of scope. Well, what does that mean? Well, when you call a function in this manner, yes, you're passing to swap two values, A and B, or in this case, A and B, but what you're getting is copies of what's ever passed in. So what this line is literally saying here is call the function called swap, pass as its first and second arguments respectively, the copies of X and Y, or more specifically, the values X and Y, which are 1 and 2. So yes, A and B do take on the values 1 and 2, and by this blinking cursor, is it true that A and B have been swapped, where my cursor is blinking? So yes, absolutely. I mean, just conceptually, that makes sense. I have a temporary variable so that I don't clobber my values, and I can swap the two values. Unfortunately, the moment that function ends, that is, returns, and in this case, it doesn't return a value. Like we said Monday, it's void, which means it just returns and doesn't give back anything. Yes, A and B have been swapped, but again, they're copies of X and Y. So X and Y are purely unaffected. So yeah, you swap two values perfectly, but the wrong two values. So we're going to see over time a solution to this problem. And as your first answer suggested, there's going to be this difference between passing by value, which this is, and passing by pointer, or passing by reference. But more on that to come. But the related sort of concepts here is that in between these two curly braces and the swap function is what's called a different scope. These variables here exist independently of those variables in main. So a rule of thumb, and it's not always safe to rely on this, is that variables only exist between the most recently and closing curly braces, which is to say X and Y exist within main only, and A and B exist within swap. And just to make things a little spicy here, what if I simply said, you know what? I don't like this choice of variable names, A and B. I'm going to say X and Y, because when I think of two variables, I think of X and Y. Worrisome now is that what? Well, these two things happen to be named the same. So does this solve our problem? Well, let's try. So let's change this to X, and then this A has got to become an X here, and then this B has got to become a Y, and then this B has also got to become a Y. So at this point in the story, if I save this, where my blinking cursor is, are X and Y now swapped? Okay, yes, no, so the answer is sort of in the middle. It depends. It depends on your perspective. Which X and Y have been swapped? Okay, so this copy of X and Y. It just so happens that I chose identically named variables, but the concept is the same. The values passed in are merely copies of what's in main. So even though these happen to, by coincidence, be named X and Y, it does not affect the X and Y that are in main scope. So just realize that it depends only on where the variables were declared, not so much on what they were called. So what's the solution to this? At this point, on this Wednesday of week two, we don't have means of fixing this problem just yet. We don't have the syntax, the features of C, but in just a couple of days' time, we will. Any questions on these matters of scope and of what are called local variables and temporary variables, which was implied by the name temp? Any questions? Well, just a sanity check. Why did I need that temporary variable? Right? If all I want to do is swap two values, why can't I just... Right, so that's the catch, right? If you try to move X to Y, fine, but now you've just clobbered Y. So now you have two copies of X, and thus you need this temporary variable. When we get to bitwise operators, which some of you have looked at for the Hacker Edition, when we get to it in the course formally, there's this really cool trick. We're using bitwise operators. That is, operating on these variables at the bit level, not on this higher level decimal level, you can actually move two variables from one to the other simultaneously without actually clobbering any variables. And it's a rather cool thing and relies on knowing a bit about bits. So let's take a look now at this example. So if there's this notion of a local variable, presumably there's a non-local variable concept, and there is, and it's that of global variables. So take a look, if you would, at buggy4.cc. So again, you do have printouts of these from Monday. This main routine appears to do what? Again, quick sanity check. Main method does what, in layman's terms? Just keeps, it adds one, it seems to increment, presumably add one to the variable x. Prints its first value, increments it, prints its second value. Again, it's a leading question because this thing's called buggy. Well, why does this not work? Well, here's our increment function. All right, it doesn't return anything, and that's fine because all we want to do is change a value, not return one. X plus plus, syntactically, is that correct? This plus plus thing? Yeah, I mean, remember that that's just a shorthand notation for what longer notation? X plus 1, right? That's really explicit. There's actually another way you can express this. Plus equals 1 or plus plus. So three different ways to accomplish the same task. Realize that you can only do this plus plus with unary incrementation. Adding 1, there's no like plus 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 for 2 or plus 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 for 3 and so forth. Okay? You only go so far. But this code is not going to work. So let's go ahead and save as it is. This is buggy 4.c. Oops. So this is buggy 4.c, okay, doesn't compile. What's wrong? Do I need libs? This always seems to fix our problems. All right, no, so what's the problem here? So the first error you see, and this is actually a good lesson for those of you programming for the first time. Many of you, getting three error messages in problem set one is probably a good thing, right? The scary thing is when it fills the screen. But the place to start typically, honestly, even if this isn't sort of intuitive, is the first line. Because compilers like GCC eventually, especially if your code's really bad, eventually get really, really confused. So it's not safe to sort of pluck off the error that's the closest to your prompt, the bottommost one. Don't pluck off the one that you happen to understand that's in the middle, because often if you make one mistake somewhere, it sort of has this cascade effect and then everything gets confused. So start at the top of the messages. The first one here says that the error is in buggy4.c, and that makes sense. When it says colon and then a number, that indicates the line number. So you already have there a good hint, and then you have hopefully a somewhat helpful error message. X undeclared, first use in this function. So that's pretty specific. So let's go back to Nano. Buggy4.c. Notice if you haven't already, when you do scroll in Nano, you have this big white rectangle telling you where you are. Well, if we scroll down to 40, that's where x is mentioned, so it makes sense. But x is undeclared. But I did declare x up in main. So what's up? Sorry? All right, so it is independent of main, right? This is in direct conflict with what we promised earlier, which is that these variables only exist within the scope of the curly braces that enclose them. So yeah, x exists in main, but it doesn't exist in increment. So how do we solve this problem? Well, it turns out that just as there are local variables that do only belong in the functions you define them in, you can kind of cheat, if not cut a corner, and open up and use what's called a global variable. And if we open up global.c, notice that this thing is a little longer in the main method, but I'm using, again, this variable x. But where have I declared x? And again, to declare a variable means to say what its type is, what its name is, and then either a semicolon or an assignment, an equal sign. So where did x come from? Go ahead. Oh, was this? No? Where is x? The answer is in that piece of paper. Okay, good. So it's up, right? So what is different about this file is that at the top, besides just declaring the library that I want to use for printf, is notice that I even explicitly commented it, int x. So I'm declaring this apparently outside all possible curly braces. So intuitively, it's not scoped to any set of curly braces. It's sort of global. It's readable by anyone. And that's precisely what a global variable is. It's accessible to any function that you might write within this file. And in fact, you can actually access global variables from other files, albeit with a bit more syntax. And there's this thing up here too, which also existed in our swap file, even though I didn't draw our attention to it. Why am I saying void increment, open parenthesis, close parenthesis, semicolon, even though I don't do anything with increment until way down here? Well, what's the role of these so-called function prototypes, where a function prototype is simply a restatement of its return type, if any, or void, the name of a function, and then in parentheses, any and all arguments that it might take. Why do I appear to have this redundancy there? This is not a question you should know the answer to if you've never done this before. Yeah. Yeah, so just like you would declare a variable to sort of tell the compiler, hey, get ready to use a variable, same deal here. With C, you have to, at the top of your file, declare your functions and tell the compiler what they look like, what structure to expect. And it's frankly a stupid requirement of C. More recently invented programming languages, Java, for instance, don't have this very stringent requirement that you tell the compiler what to expect. Rather, these days, especially given that CPUs are so much faster, my God, you have a computer. Let the computer go search through the file and find the thing. And that is what's done today. Not so much in C. So in C, when you have other functions, you either have to declare them at the top here before using them and before implementing them, or another workaround here would actually be for me to move my entire function above the first place where I try to call it. So another convention is you can just try to put most of your functions on top of your main function. The only downside of that, frankly, is that for readability's sake, I think it's a better convention that the first thing in a program be main, so you don't have to go fishing for it. So better, I think, is to get in this habit of declaring function prototypes up top and then simply implementing them wherever you see fit. I tend to do it alphabetically below main. Okay, so back to the question at hand. X is declared outside the scope of these functions, so it turns out that now this program, global.c, will in fact work. So what do? In main, it looks like I'm initializing X in this blinking line to be 1. Now I'm just printing out some fluffy debugging information. Then I'm calling increment. I'm not passing it anything. I'm not doing anything with what it returns because it doesn't return anything. And then I just print out X again. So let's go ahead and compile global.c, run a.out, and now it appears to have worked. Yes, we're not swapping values, we're incrementing them this time, but the idea is the same because we've encapsulated that functionality in a separate function. The takeaway then is global variables can solve this problem, and now just as we give you some new feature, we're now going to take it away. Typically, global variables are considered bad design. You can almost always avoid using global variables if you instead use parameter passing. That is, provide an input to a function and take back some output. By that I mean we could have implemented the same idea if I really was ignorant of the existence of, say, the plus plus operator or plus equals. What we could have done is this. Say, you know what, increment's not just going to return void. It's actually going to return a useful value, and it's going to take an input. It's going to take an integer called input, and what I'm actually going to return is input plus 1. Now up here, what do I have to change in this increment line for this now to work? Yeah, so pass it x so it knows what to increment, and then reassign x the result. That obviates the need for this thing at all, and that would be considered an instance of better design. So for now, know that global variables exist, especially as we show you more complicated code, which might sometimes use global variables for various reasons, but don't get in the habit just yet of using them, because you can almost always avoid it with a more clever design. Yeah?
If you're going to use the plus plus
Oh, so no. In that case, you could do return input plus plus, and it would actually bind earlier than the return statement, because just intuitively, it wouldn't really make sense to return a value and then do something with it. You need to know what the value is, but the effect here is immaterial, because now what you're doing is incrementing input, yes, then you're returning that value, but there's no reason to actually change input itself, because it's only scoped to this function. It's going to disappear in a second anyway. But it would work in the way you described. All right, let's take a look at one final buggy example, this one in buggy5.c. So in buggy5.c, we have a program that's supposed to increment a variable that, let's see, GCC of buggy5, run a.out, and clearly this program is broken. So why is it? To sort of recap what we've looked at. So here's the program. We've apparently got a global variable x up top. We've got a function prototype, a declaration up top, so that the compiler knows that I'm going to implement an increment function. Here's my main function. Print what the value of x is, which should, the first time this executes, be what? Oh, that's weird. So it's not initialized. But what did we see a moment ago when we ran it? So it was zero by default. So we'll come back to that point. Generally, not safe to just assume that variables are going to have values, but clearly they must by nature of how this stuff works. There's going to be bits there. What they are, we'll get to in a bit. But here, we're printing out x. Then I'm assigning x equal to 1. So now I print out in this blinking line, obviously, what value? All right, so 1, so that works. Now I scroll down a bit. I call this increment function. I claim that it's incremented, and then I print out its value again. But we saw that this program printed 0, 1, 1, which was clearly not incremented. So let's take a look. Here's increment this time. Doesn't return anything, doesn't take anything. But notice it is incrementing x. But here's another instance of that same issue. So just intuitively, what must be going on here to cause this problem? Exactly. So this is sort of the next and final sort of conversation point in this matter of scoping and global and local. Because we've declared another variable x in this scope, and this scope is tighter to the use of that variable. It's the most recently opened set of curly braces. It's this x that, quote unquote, shadows any other version of x that might also otherwise be in scope. So even though we declared that global variable up here, and normally we should be able to access him anywhere, turns out that this variable x shadows it, just like an identically named parameter to a function would, as in an example a couple of minutes ago. Okay, so enough on scope and locality and such. Any questions on those examples? Yeah, in back. What's that? Why doesn't it print 11? Okay, an excellent question. So again, let's rerun this thing, and we do indeed see 0, 1, 1. So why don't we see 11? We'll take a look again at what's going on. So in increment, at the blinking line, we're declaring a new variable, a local variable called x, and it is indeed getting the value 10. In the next line that's now blinking, what happens? Just point out the obvious. What happens to x? It gets incremented. So at this point where my cursor is blinking, what's the value of x? It is 11. This value of x is 11. But again, the moment that function returns, any local variables it had essentially disappear. They evaporate. And so what gets printed up here on this blinking line now is the copy of x, or the version of x that's in scope at that point. And at that point, the only version of x that's in scope isn't even a local variable, because clearly we've declared none in main, but rather the one and only variable called x that's still in scope, which is that global one. So that's why we don't see 11, because that value got thrown away. It evaporated. But we do, in fact, see 1 again, because that variable is still in scope. Yeah?
If we took away the int in our other function, would we then get 11? Like, if we didn't declare it?
OK, an excellent case. So let's go ahead and remove the declaration and just say x gets 10. Let's go ahead and save this, recompile, and run a.out. What are we going to see? Well, that wasn't very unanimous or enthusiastic, but indeed, it is in fact 11. Because now you're no longer redeclaring a new variable, you're just assigning the global variable a new value. Excellent. All right, so a sneak peek at some of the underlying explanations for all of this stuff. And this is sort of computer hardware meets memory 101 in about 60 seconds, because we will come back to this in the conversation about pointers ultimately. So it turns out, when you run a program, whether you double-click it on your Windows or Mac machine, or you just type its command, like a.out at the command line, what happens is the operating system takes all those zeros and ones that are on disk, loads them into memory. That is RAM. Well, what does that mean? It essentially means that the operating system says, you know what, I'm going to reserve, say, a bunch of megabytes or a bunch of gigabytes just for your program. I'm going to copy all the zeros and ones in your executable, in a.out or in aim.exe, and I'm going to put them someplace in RAM. And the place it typically puts them, if we view the amount of memory that your operating system reserves for each program as a rectangle, it happens to put them in the top. And we call this the text segment. But again, this is a topic we'll come back to. Meanwhile, though, it uses the memory at the bottom of this rectangle in the amount of space it's allocated for what's called the stack. Anytime you call a function in a C-based program, and this happens underneath the hood in a lot of the programs you're running, say, on your Mac or PC today, if they're written in C or even C++, anytime you call a function, that function gets its own chunk of memory, its own frame, so to speak, its own stack frame. And what that means is that the operating system reserves a bunch of bytes, kilobytes, megabytes, however many is appropriate, in the overall space that's reserved in RAM for your program. Main's memory gets tucked away at the bottom of this chunk of memory, so to speak. Its parameters come first, and then any local variables come next. So where you see main parenthesis, this is just mean to suggest that any local variables end up here, and any parameters end up here. If in main, I have a call, that is, I use a function called foo, well, the operating system also gives foo a chunk of its own memory for its parameters, if any, and also any of its local variables. So if you called not foo, but printf, and we should, in fact, finally reveal what foo is. If you call printf, well, printf is what gets put on top of main's chunk of memory in your computer's RAM, and any of its arguments, which are your format string, and maybe int x and y, anything you pass to printf, and then any local variables that whoever wrote printf happen to use in that library. If you call something else from within a function, things just get stacked on top, on top, on top, on top, like trays in a cafeteria. Turns out that this design is wonderfully straightforward, but also has its weaknesses. And in a few weeks' time, when we actually look at some of the security implications for coding programs in C and in C++, this simple design actually explains, or rather, man's poor implementation of this idea rather explains many, I dare say a majority, of the security exploits you hear about today, including perhaps that in the iPhone, which ultimately boiled down to, I believe, what's called a stack overflow or a buffer overflow. Well, that relates to precisely this picture. Essentially, those kinds of hacks use more memory than they should. They use memory that doesn't belong to them. Okay, so we did get an email yesterday about those less comfortable perhaps being equivalent to those who don't know what foo means. So when a computer scientist talks in terms of variables, x and y are kind of boring, right? That's mathematician speak. We instead talk in terms of foo and bar and baz. And then after that, it gets a little debatable. Some people say quux. And then some people say after that, if they need another variable, quux with two u's. And then after that, and then it gets pretty stupid after that. But if you Google terms like foo, bar, baz, I mean, you'll see like little treatises on the web as to what the standard should be for computer scientists' variable names. I'll defer to, say, Wikipedia or the like for the history of this, debatable as it may be. But essentially, anytime a TFRI says foo or bar or baz, it's just the habit we've gotten into to using it as a verbal placeholder, a variable. It may or may not be the case. Again, I'll defer to Wikipedia. Foobar, of course, has another spelling, which if you Google this, you might come up with something different. F-U-B-A-R. I'll let you look that one up at home. But for our purposes, they're just variables. It's not, we're not trying to be offensive every time we say foobar in the class. All right. Any questions on foobar, baz, quux, 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 or the like? All right. So that's foobar and baz. Now we're all on the same page. So let's take a look, just to be more precise, at this idea of return values. But we've seen it so many times, we won't spend much time here at all. So functions, just as they can take inputs, can also take outputs. And that much we've seen several times over now. So these things are called return values. And just as we've seen with some of our examples implicitly, you must specify what a function's going to return, if anything. If it doesn't return anything, that is, if it's meaningless to say x gets foo, yeah, there it is already. If this is meaningless because foo doesn't return anything, well, what do you write as the so-called return type for foo in its declaration or prototype? A void. So void is just what you say. And what you might also see in certain code examples is sometimes when a programmer writes a function that doesn't take any parameters, to be explicit, they too will sometimes write void, but inside the parentheses, just to make it clear that nothing's going in. I, by convention, just leave it open parenthesis, close parenthesis, and save myself four characters. So here's an example of a function that's a little more sensible than, say, increment, which was pretty stupid because all it does is increment by one. We have other syntax for that. But we don't have a nice shortcut for cubing a value, raising it to the third power. So if you were to implement a function like that, and this is precisely in the spirit of code that might be nice to implement once and not copy and paste constantly in a file that's doing some mathematics, here's a function, takes a variable a, it returns a times a times a, that is a cubed, and returns it as an int. And all the int is indicating is that it does indeed return a value. And let's just take a quick look at return 2, just to see what's enlightening there. And nothing terribly interesting. That's just going to demonstrate that precise idea. So any questions on inputs and outputs to functions, aka parameters and return values? Yeah. So whenever it returns the type of value that you specify. So if I, for instance, happen to return what's a float, but I said the function returns an int, you would either get a warning from the compiler just saying, whoa, do you mean to be doing that? Or it will just work. But what's going to happen is what we've seen happening in certain demos is you're going to lose the precision. It's going to get returned as an int, but everything after the decimal point is going to get chopped off and thrown away. So you have to be cognizant of the implications. Other questions? Yeah.
Can you go the other way around? If you want to get a floating number out, you go float cube and then call it int, so you wouldn't lose precision. But is it capable of figuring that out?
Sure. So if in the other direction you actually had an integral value, a is int, but you want to return a float. So yeah, if I did change this declaration to be not int but float, even if these things were ints, what would get returned is a float. So it would be, if the input is 1, it'd be 1 times 1 times 1, but 1.0 would essentially get returned. So it only breaks things if you are going from something that's more precise to less precise. But even then, if you're doing that, you're making assumptions, and better to explicitly cast things so that it's clear that it's not a mistake on your part, but intentional to you as well when you look at the code weeks later. All right, so we finally now have a way of expressing different types of data structures in memory. Thus far, we've been relying on these primitives, ints and chars and such. And there's only so much of interest that you can do with these things. We finally have the ability, as of right now, to use what are called arrays, which are perhaps a simple data structure which allow you to allocate, that is, reserve space for multiple variables at once. This is a picture that I took from one of the recommended online resources on the course's website that gives you one sort of picture that represents the idea of an array. But essentially, all an array is as follows. Typically, when you declare a variable like x at the top of your program, well, we already know that the RAM required to represent this int involves how many bits or bytes if it's an int on a typical machine? 32 bits, or 4 bytes. So that's how much memory needs to get taken up by this. Where does that memory come from? Well, again, to come back to this preliminary story, it ends up in a chunk of memory on the so-called stack. That's where those 4 bytes are conceptually. All right, well, that's all fine and good, but suppose I'm writing a program to take a student's grades in, and I want to compute someone's average. Well, so if a kid takes 4 classes a semester, or 32 courses over college, you know, you could certainly say int x1, x2, x3, and then x4, and then ad nauseum all the way down to, say, x32. All right, that would work, but something should rub you the wrong way about that. At some point, it becomes tedious to write, tedious to read, and hopefully just stupid sounding, because you have a computer here. Hopefully, there's a better way of expressing this. And there is, and it's with what are called arrays. If you want to have a bunch of variables of the same data type at your disposal, the syntax is almost the same as before, but let's call this now, say, grades will be the name of my variable. But it's not just going to be one int. It's going to be a collection of, let's say, 32 ints. So simply by declaring your variable as this, what you're essentially telling the compiler, give me 32 ints, and call them collectively grades. If I now want to do something with these values, like put a number into this chunk of memory, I can say grades, and then in brackets, not 32, because that declares the size, but the index in this array. So the first grade in an array, odds are, is going to be referenced by what number in computer science? Yeah, so 0. So grade 0 might get the value, well, I don't know, so I'm going to say get int, and use CS50's library to populate that value. And obviously, if I want to do another one, I'd say grades again, but this time I would put 1 and then do the same. But beware, think about it too briefly. You might write something like that. What's the problem? All right, so there is no 32. And unfortunately, with C, the behavior is sometimes undefined. What essentially is happening, again, in this picture we've started drawing, is that even though grades 0 through 31 fit within, say, maybe foo's frame on the stack, its chunk of memory, grades 32 is one int over. It's 32 bits over. Who knows where that is or who that belongs to? It belongs to someone other than foo in this case, and that tends to be a bad thing. But it's this idea, actually, that underlies, again, these things like the iPhone hacks. So that idea of a buffer overflow, well, buffer is just kind of a fancier way of saying an array. This is an array. This is a contiguous block of memory chunked up into sizes equivalent to what data type you want. Well, it's like a buffer. You can just fill it with any number of variables. The problem is that when people write code carelessly, without due thought to security, they will sometimes run the risk in their own code of accessing things like grades 32. The problem is, if you have the ability to write this some value, like 99, I might be adding the number 99 to someone else's chunk of memory. And essentially, all of these so-called buffer overflow exploits, which again we'll come back to toward term's end, generally rely on hackers throwing some unknown values into a computer program, trusting that they're going to get written in an unexpected location. If the result of that writing of data happens to crash the program, that typically means to the hacker, ooh, I found a mistake. It doesn't mean the software is insecure just yet, but it means there's a mistake. And usually you can take advantage of such mistakes. And so if a hacker realizes, wow, I can crash this program, I can make my iPhone reboot unexpectedly, maybe I cannot write just random data, but actual programming code that he writes himself very carefully, and essentially trick the computer not into putting a number 99 there, but to putting a function that the hacker wrote. And in the case of the iPhone, and I'm simplifying because that was a big chunk of code, it could very well be just a function he wrote that simply says unlock iPhone, I mean, or the equivalent. And that's really, in a nutshell, how this all works, and it trusts in memory being laid out in this sort of stack-like manner. So, what can we do with these things? Well, let's take a look at array.c. So up in array.c, we have two lines here. We're using two libraries, CS50s and the standard IO. Then the next line down is a piece of new syntax. It's not really that hard to grasp. This is just what's known as a constant. If there's some number, generally an int or a float, that you just want to use throughout your code, because you know a priori what that number should be, you can declare it as a so-called constant. And the syntax for that is sharp define space, the name of the constant, which by convention tends to be all uppercase, and I would urge you to follow that convention if you do this, followed by the value. No semicolon. So this is sort of a simple example of what's known as a macro, too. These can be used for different purposes. This, too, there's a bit of religion here whereby this is not necessarily the best way to do this, but it is, dare say, the most common way of doing this. And you'll even see us doing it occasionally because it gets the job done easily without great, if any, risk. But more on that in the time to come. Actually, well, let's just toss the question out there. What might be an alternative, based on today's conversation alone, to declaring a constant value like this? What other sort of feature might we use of C? Yeah, so you could actually use a global variable, and you can specify a global variable's value must remain constant with the keyword C-O-N-S-T, const, but we'll see that in the time to come. For now, this is useful for getting the job done. Yeah, question? What would be the advantage of specifying quizzes to be what? So perfect question, actually, to explain this. So here's the question. Who cares? Why would you bother doing this? Well, let's see if the intuition pops out at anyone. Yeah?
Well, because if you
want to
change the values, then you just change it in one place.
So that's the most compelling reason, perhaps. If you want to change that value because you change your mind, and all of a sudden next semester this course doesn't have three quizzes but four, well, you change it one place, and then it changes everywhere effectively. And that's perhaps the most compelling reason to do so. Also, another reason, if more subtle, is that it tends to make code more readable. If you can set the reader's expectations, and I don't just mean a TF, I mean people like you who come to course's end are probably going to be downloading libraries from the web maybe for your own projects, or just generally looking at code not written by you. It immediately is obvious to you when reading this file, quizzes is going to be a variable I'm going to see throughout, or really a constant throughout. It's going to be assigned the variable 3, and it's clear. Rather than just happening to lace the numbers 3 all throughout the document, that, yeah, I could find if I did like a control F and search for all values of 3, but it just gets very annoying to maintain that quickly, and it's also less clear. But a perfect question to ask here. So let's take a look at what this program's doing. We're already deploying this new syntax. Turns out that I don't want to represent in this version grades as ints. We want more precision, so we're going to use floats so that we can say give and take away half points. But the goal of this program is to compute someone's average. And we can do this in many ways, but the straightforward way we chose is to declare a variable called average, one called sum, and then one called I. And collectively, we can use those to solve this easy mathematical problem. So the first thing this program does is it's going to ask the user for some input. So let's run arrays. Let's compile arrays and run it. What were your quiz score? Well, you did really well that first week. And then you did not so well the second week. And then you kind of redeemed yourself the third. So we seem to have a program that figures out your average is 80, assuming we don't drop any scores. All right, well, how is this thing working? Well, again, in array.c, notice that here at the blinking line, we have a loop that's using this constant to iterate three times, it turns out. Each time we say quiz something of something, and then we populate this array with the values. Is there a risk of this array, of this code, accessing memory in the array that it doesn't belong to it? As in this corner case here. Is there a danger? No, right? Because I declared the array up here, but because I use the constant there, I'm getting precisely as much memory as I need. And so long as I don't do something accidental like that, misremembering how we're supposed to count if we do start at zero, the code is perfectly okay. So we fill the array with values here. Now we scroll down. And again, we can do this even in fewer lines of code. But for clarity's sake, I initialize sum to be zero. Then I iterate again over the array, just to show you that just as you can iterate it to populate it, you can iterate it to look at the values afterward. I'm going to add to this variable sum the each ith value of the grades array. And then finally, I do this craziness. And I offer this for the opposite of clarity's sake, but to show you a little trick. So average here does indeed compute someone's average, but we round up. If in the event you have like an 81.6, this will give you an 82 instead of an 81. By contrast, if we just relied on casting from float to int, what would happen to some of your scores? All right, so we'd be rounding down, and several of you would probably be annoyed with that. So here's a better way of rounding. Turns out there's a math library in C. Some of you have been using it for power functions and the like. We haven't even shown it yet, which is fine, but there's also a round function in there. Well, we can implement round ourselves. So what's going on here? Well, taking someone's average really amounts to adding up all the values and dividing by how many values there were. Pretty straightforward. So here's the sum. Why am I casting quizzes to a float? So I'm not just doing sum divided by quizzes, which mathematically is right. I'm doing this cast. Why? Right. Exactly. We want the whole thing treated as a float. And we've seen this before with simple examples. Previously, I added a decimal point to a number. Here, I'm casting it so that we get a floating point value. So that gives us a value. Why might I be adding 0.5 to the end? So this is a little rounding trick. And again, this is sort of a, you know, hacker's little tool, but even this one's pretty trivial. Suppose your grade is an 81.2. Well, if you add 0.5 to that, so that gives you 81.7. But then what am I doing at the leftmost line of this expression, the leftmost side of this expression? I'm casting it back to an int. So that throws away the 0.7 and gives you an 81, which was your correct grade, because 81.2 should get rounded down. By contrast, if you had an 81.6, add 0.5 to that, that gives you 82.1. Now I cast it away to an int, we throw away the remainder, and now you're left with your 82. So it's this little trick for rounding that, again, just reminds us of some of these casting issues. And finally, we print out the score. Well, what else might we look at here? Let's take a look at this one. Buggy C. So in Buggy C, this program is supposed to print out a value. Rather, this program is supposed to take in the scores from the user and then print them out. So let's go ahead and run. This is Buggy 6 through the compiler. Let's go ahead and run it. And now it's going to ask me, what's my quiz score? So I'm going to give it 100 this time, a 90, an 80. But wow, something weird just happened. So this brings us back to that point earlier where, remember earlier, I used that variable x and printed its value, and it happened to equal 1. Well, buyer beware. In this case, I'm doing something wrong. If we look at the code, what is wrong? Why did 10 scores just print rather than just the 3? I mean, quite simply, and again, leading question, but I screwed up, right? I used what's called a magic number, which just refers to the act of hard coding a value into your program, which, in answer to your question earlier, just tends to be bad practice, because even though everywhere else I iterated over quizzes, down here, maybe because this is the way I first implemented the program and forgot to change it, I'm iterating from 0 to 10. So I'm trying to print 10 grades, but I only put 3 there, and how much space did I, in fact, reserve for this array? Just 3. So we're getting these bogus values down here when I run this thing. So where are those values coming from? So clearly from memory, and presumably in that picture, just after the space allocated for this grades array. But beyond that, we don't know. Sometimes this will crash the program, sometimes it won't. Let's just see for kicks if I go ahead in nano and I change it not to 100, but just to really push our luck, 1,000, so that we're iterating over 1,000 ints, most of which, 997, don't even belong to us. Recompile. Here's 100, here's 90, here's 80. Some crazy stuff. And this is essentially, in a nutshell, how a lot of exploits are conducted. Because once you have access to a computer's memory in this arbitrary fashion with no controls in place, it kind of gives you unlimited access to do most anything you want. Ergo, the iPhone hack. So with that said, we'll see you on Friday.